would have waited an eternity for this. It's over, Prime.
Greetings, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Hursko. Joining me this evening are fellow board members, Andrew Leff.
Hey.
And James Gifford.
Chicken paw, chicken paw, chicken paw, paw.
And the topic of tonight's or today's episode, depending upon where you listen, we're going to talk about frameworkless transformations. So typically in the industry, you see a lot of companies willing to go agile, gratuitous air quotes there, and they 9 times out of 10 will choose a framework type solution. We're going to talk about what happens if you don't, why would you not want to use a framework, and then all the things that go around that. So not less agile out of the box, more agile on the fly. So I'm going to start off with a question, and I'm going to start with you, Leff, and then I'm going to go over to Gifford. So what's the potential impetus for a company looking to start a transformation and not go with a predetermined industry standard framework? Like what would be some reasons a company would not want to, or even what would be some scenarios where maybe it's in your best interest to not even think about going down that box solution path?
I think when I think through that question, it's around, you know, you've, as an organization, you may have identified the opportunity to improve somewhere, do something different, or you're just in a rut, right? So you need to shake things up. So maybe not jumping into the a framework right away, but really defining what's important, what's the change management around the ideas that you're coming up with, and how would you go about creating pieces of work around, you know, if you want to call them epics or whatever we want to title them as, but those units of work around how we want to start changing and driving towards more transformative behavior.
Okay, so you're thinking it's more of a, I have a change that I know is coming that I want to get deep into the weeds to, instead of overthinking it, maybe to poke at it, doing something without going both feet in. Is that what you're actually thinking?
Yeah, and sometimes like when you dangle the agile carrot out there, people are like, oh, we can move really fast now, right? We're agile. Or we can do whatever the hell we want because we're agile. Or, you know, I always hear that, well, we can change that on the fly because we're agile. And I'm just, it almost like creates a bias, and it's not really an accurate one. So you can do lots of those things, but, you know, what is creating that sense of change, and what is the behavior you need to start altering within your organization to support an agile way of working, a framework, a methodology, a playbook, whatever you want to call it.
Okay, Gifford, same question to you. What would be the impetus, perceived benefit, maybe not going with the framework? What's the solution that, and I know you have experience with actually doing a transformation where you didn't go down the stereotypical, say, safe path or scrum and scale path. What would be the impetus for you for a company not wanting to use a framework?
I mean, it just really depends on the outcomes that you're looking for. Like, you know, we've all kind of talked about, like, what, you know, how agile does your organization want to be? And, you know, we've lost the, you know, agile has just become synonymous with Scrum. And so there's enough literature out there in the, you know, plethora of books. I think the only more books on Amazon than agile books are self-help books, which after trying to do agile, you just need to go read the self-help books. So, I mean, So we understand that implementing Scrum or doing anything from a big box framework, you're just basically throwing a hand grenade in your organization because most people don't actually manage change well. So from the impetus of that standpoint, you know, one of the things that always kind of resonated with me when I read Anderson's Blue Book for the first time and learning about Kanban, it was respect what we do today and agree to continuously improve. Well, most organizations cannot survive a constant state of continuous improvement. So, you know, kind of to Andrew's point, like when we look at, you know, let's find better ways of working and let's figure out what are big problems that our organization has, and then kind of evolve those to basically make the process better. So, it's like one of the things that you look at. We, you know, in a couple of the organizations I've been in, they have, you know, essentially non-disciplined waterfall teams that don't really have any accountability. They just kick the can, they kick the can, they kick the can. It'll be done tomorrow. No, it'll be done 2 weeks from now. Oh, shoot, 2 weeks came and gone and went by. And it's like, well, all right, well, out of all the agile practices, you know, the idea of a time box, the idea of Scrum, a two-week iteration, a four-week iteration, it puts a bounding box in there with the expectation that you're going to get something done. So a better outcome for the organization would be slightly more predictable delivery on whether it's a bunch of tasks, it's, you know, components, if you don't want to even get into cross-functional teams at that point. But there's an outcome, there's practices that Agile prescribes that can help build some of the discipline in your organization. So it's, if you do want to continuously improve, it's how do you throttle change in your organization and actually manage it, to Andrew's point. But then what problems in your organization are you trying to solve, and what kind of Agile practices can you, you know, I mean, it takes a lot of knowledge around the practices and what kind of the context they're trying to solve. But, you know, time boxing, the daily stand-up is something every project team most likely could use, whether it's 15 minutes, 30 minutes, like looking at these practices based on the problems you have in your organization, start to work to integrate those in. And I know Andrew and I kicked around the idea a long time ago about turning up the good on waterfall. How do you basically start to take these agile practices and lay them into waterfall to get better outcomes? And we're kind of, you know, we're, you know, I'm kind of interestingly in a place where now I kind of own two SDLCs. I own the waterfall SDLC and I own the agile SDLC. And as the time goes on, we're bringing more, we have parts of the organization that will never make the transformation. They will never go to agile, but we need to basically say we need to make these guys better. So, you know, how do we limit WIP so that we're, or use prioritization techniques with the business? So give us your top 10 feature list. I know you've got 35 for your waterfall that you'd love to stuff in this release, but like for right now, give us your top 10. And once we get through those, whatever time left, we'll just keep picking up the next one. And you know, I know you have 35 on the list. We may only get to 20. But you know what? You're getting way more value, and we're not killing these people and bringing down morale.
So you're almost thinking, James, that it really comes down to, I mean, your first line was, it depends on how agile you want to be. So it really, the idea of using a framework versus not using a framework really comes down to how, it sounds to me like your thesis is it comes down to the company really knowing what they want to do and where they want to go. And if you don't know what you want to do and where you want to go, I can see, and I'm just going to theorize here, I can see where the appeal of a framework then comes in, because it helps you figure out where you want to go, why you're getting there. Is that a, what do you think, Lef? Is that a true statement or?
Yeah, I think so. And I have a couple of thoughts on this too. And I think when you kind of touch on a couple of the points both of you are bringing up around. So to me, it's having the organization be able to visualize the amount of edges they're about to cross. And those edges are uncomfortable. So if you stack them up and visually like create an icon that shows every edge that you're going to put the organization through to cross, that amount of change puts you in a state of resistance. So you can only accommodate so much change in one point in time. So I think that when we approach things, hey, use this framework, that can inject a lot of change, which will stifle transformation. Right? It's going to be too much. People are going to get too uncomfortable and they get into a state of fatigue. So it's hard. And something that James and I experienced and with some of his thought leadership at one of an engagement that we were both on was around, you know, not necessarily approaching it holistically from a framework perspective, but almost journey map. What are the things we want to do? And then have the framework reveal itself on this is opportunities that we've identified based upon the work that we're looking to deliver and the value that that brings. So let's work backwards, and which is weird, right? That should not be backwards, but it feels very backwards and bottom. You know, we tend to work from the bottom up, but when you start to define yourself as a product organization and how do you define your product, sometimes those frameworks can just, or even methodologies will reveal themselves out of that discussion. And then you can start looking at, well, this makes sense for us. And hey, we need to stretch ourselves to do this. And then you can start accommodating almost that blast radius mentality of how much change do we want to do and how much is affected in the organization? And do we want to be really close to the blast or do we want to put this further out?
I think you make a very valid point, that whole idea of organizational elasticity, where there's only so much you can absorb. And I just finished reading the Spiral Dynamics book, and a giant chunk of the book is all about, you know, noticing when you're ripe for change, noticing the signs that change is coming, how to navigate it. And one of the remarks that's made in the book is, so many change initiatives start out with announcing, we are going to change absolutely everything. And that announcement is actually, you almost poison the well. And the book talks about it. You almost poison the well in that regard, where you tell people everything is going to change, but then you like go away as you're trying to figure it out. And you forcefully put people into that liminal state where the old way isn't going to work, but they're not sure where the new way is yet. And you're right. It I can really, now that you've said it that way, I can see why organizations get burnt out, because their people can't, you know, I don't know if I could handle it, right? Oh, change is coming, and being told that every day and then not seeing it or not having any clue about the direction. I can see where that real quickly would get just, you'd lose your mind.
Yeah. And just one final, I mean, it's something that through my training now with the, you know, organizational relationship and systems coaching, we talk about this realm state, and organizations can go into this realm state, which is like a self-encapsulated negative dreaming state accompanied by like this distortion in reality. And it almost creates this low dream, you know, with its own internal logic and belief system, and it creates its own weather pattern. So it's very draining, and it's really hard to uplift out of that. So it's almost like I can never win no matter what or how hard I try, or, you know, something's always terrible going to happen. You know, they're out to get me. So that type of mentality and organization can actually become, you know, build up antibodies to transformation. Mm. It creates a resistance.
I like your usage of the term a weather pattern, because you can see that now that I look back, like I can see some of the cyclical nature I've seen and some of the transformations I've been through, where you can see you can almost see the peaks and valleys coming around the corner.
Yeah, definitely. It creates a whole different emotional field.
James, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, again, because you're in the midst of a heavy transformation, and again, we're gonna poke at it, because you're not a safe shop, you're not necessarily a Nexus shop, you're just doing your own thing. So how did that idea of like organizational elasticity, weather patterns, how did that impact some of the activities and planning that you folks have done?
Well, I mean, so we started out product based. So there were things in the organization that kind of primed it for transformation and primed it for some of these things. Like, we didn't have to go through the pain of trying to define and figure out what products were. There were product teams already existing. The functional silos within the company operated in a matrix management kind of vibe. So they're used to having people from their silo having to go commingle with other people from their silo. And so the footprint for kind of starting to introduce some of these practices, you don't need a scaling framework when you have like smaller than 10 teams. Yes, the Nexus helps, but a lot of that stuff you can facilitate with simple Scrum of Scrum practices. So organizationally, they were set up to not have to do major reorganizations. They had the concept of matrix management, so pulling together cross-functional teams wasn't a stretch. It was taking that 30-person cross-functional team and then having them go through an exercise of figuring out, all right, well, how can you 30 people want to work together to form three teams of people delivering smaller bits of work? So in our context, there were foundational things that were in place that kind of smoothed it along. And we've, you know, we've helped different groups try to make that pivot from the idea of, you know, their siloed functional base and needing to do components. I've been in there. We've had the ones where we've had different parts of the company basically working on the same product, but really to give everything had its own unique identity. So it was more about what is the customer journey for the entire platform they're building. A lot of it kind of tied into some of that domain-driven design discussion that we had a few shows back. So it's really kind of, what's your organization look like today? And, you know, if you come in and say, you know, you've got a director there that's been building this empire, and they're like, I've got 200 people that report up into me. I am now God. And you show up and you're like, hey, I need 10 of this guy. I need 5 of this guy. And I need them to go work over here. And that's what your organization's built on. You know, the weather pattern's going to start. There's going to be a hurricane over here, tornado over there, tsunami, typhoon. And it's just going to be a lot of chaos. You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, Alistair kind of posted that a long time ago on Facebook, of all places, about the, I forget the name of the company, but they basically said, hey, we're opening up this new building, and anybody that goes into this new building is going to go work in this kind of way. And everybody that wanted to kind of be agile and be part of this, and the early adopters, or the innovators, they went to the new building and started working. And then they told their friends about how awesome it was. And then, you know, they started bringing in the early adopters. And then at some point they needed to cross the chasm to get into the next change curve. And then basically when the laggards were left, they gave them they humanely asked, you know, told them that we're no longer doing that. I mean, there is something to the Noah's Ark kind of thing.
That was Borden. Wasn't it Borden Technologies or something down in Texas? Something along those lines?
Yeah, I'd have to go find it on Facebook.
So you talked about, James, your company was pretty much already aligned around the product and the idea of the products that the company bears and then the customer journeys. Andrew, would you agree that, framework or not, that's probably where you should start, would be thinking about the products that you offer and aligning yourself to that sort of train of thought?
I like the train of thought. If I would start there, I might change the statement of starting there in regards to how do we want to deliver value and what does value look like, and you know, if that's product specific, then you would go down that route. So I think I would start with the what is of value, or how do we deliver value, and what does that look like from a product or feature or capability perspective.
Okay, so you're thinking about how we deliver value, even bigger than that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and the only reason I say that, Jay, is because we kind of lump under transformation, right? So if we want to go through some sort of transformation, that to me could be a reason for change. So is really, you know, how do we want to redefine the value we offer to the world?
Okay. I now got me thinking at my most recent, the last transformation I've been part of, that was one of the first conversations we had, is what is the value that we deliver? And we ended up calling it the hand. It was 5 different fingers, 5 different, I hate to use the term value stream because that's getting overplayed, but 5 different streams of value that we deliver with 5 different end customers, some of which are our actual customers, some of which would be people who produce value for us in lieu of helping us reach customers, all that sort of stuff. But I thought that was, that was an interesting journey, and that was something that was not led by a particular framework. Now that I think about it, we had a bunch of consultants actually help us. However, in defense of Agile frameworks, that is, I mean, I've primarily worked in safe shops, and Andrew, I know you're an SBC. There is an activity with value stream mapping, right? A value stream identification that is prescribed by SAFE, right?
Yep, absolutely, I think they introduced it in 4.5. It was this whole value, you know, the canvas mentality, right? So there is a canvas that you go through when you're doing your value streams, and it walks you through that, hey, what does value look like and how do we define it?
Okay. I knew. I thought I saw that somewhere.
But then, there is the other connotation to value streams, which is we had Karen on the show many moons ago on Jay's first solo expedition into hosting a podcast. And so one of the things that, you know, we need to do as the company where we're kind of at is actually looking at our value stream and what are the handoffs in that, almost that manufacturing kind of context. Like, we have identified products. We have an understanding of where the idea comes from and how it gets into production, but all the stuff in between could definitely use mapped out as we look to, you know, improve and re-engineer some of the ways we do things upstream from ideation to delivery. I think a lot of companies, you know, they don't ever start out with the as is to be. It's, we want to just plop Agile on top of whatever we're doing. I worked in a marketing group for a while, and the number of handoffs and queues and various audits it took to get a piece of collateral through the process without actually understanding that whole value stream and saying, hey, we want to put together a cross-functional team to kind of make this better. There were a whole lot of systems and infrastructure and tracking and things like that in place that just putting Scrum on top of that would have gone horribly wrong. Or trying to, you know, because there is all of that queuing and they don't understand the value stream and the handoffs and the approvals and the legalities of this legal department needing this and things like that. So being able to identify the value stream and the construct of, you know, Karen's book and what it looks like from a manufacturing kind of standpoint, you know, a lot of companies, like, these are kind of table stakes in my mind in embarking on any of this.
So one of the things, Andrew, you said before, which I thought was an interesting turn of phrase, is visualizing the edges, right? So visualizing that all the things that you're going to touch, they're going to get a little screwy. And this is, and I want to know if you agree with me, this is one of the blessing and the curse of using a large framework, right? Is consultants of a lesser talent, present company excluded, right? May just, when a company is trying to dip a toe in the agile water, they show up with like the safe big picture or the less picture, and they slap that on them and they say, look, here's what you're going to do. And real quickly, you can, to your point, you can visualize those edges real quickly, just looking at some of that stuff. And I think it also ties to some people that may be exciting, but maybe more people, it's a little bit terrifying. Right. And maybe that you talked about antibodies. Right. I think Simon Worley just had this quote. I've been beating this quote to death, where he talked about how somebody asked him, how long do I have to enact a change in a new organization? And his remark was, you have 90 days to make any sort of drastic change, because after that, the antibodies start. Another term he used. So I think about that. Would you agree that that's probably, I know we all know or have seen somebody come in with, like, and I hate to be not safe because it's not safe's fault, but they come in with that big picture and they try to say, look, it's like that meme, right? They just slap it on the leaky water bucket. Like, oh, here we go. Would you agree that that's probably a blessing and a curse?
Yeah, definitely. And when we talk about those organizational edges, it's, you know, I'm going to use some silly terms, but, you know, you don't want to kick everybody over the edge. You know, how do you kiss them over the edge? How do you get people to want to build the momentum of crossing over something that's uncomfortable? And it's not just a forced thing and people are following blindly, right? And jumping off a bridge and splatting on the ground.
It's a hell of a mental picture right there.
Yeah, right.
So Gifford, I'm going to go back to you for some experiential type stuff, right? So, you recently are in an organization where they said, hey, we're gonna do the Agile, to quote Johanna Rothman, do the Agile, right? What are some of the things you've noticed that if a company is looking to start a transformation, right? And I know we have an episode coming up with when to start a transformation. How do I know I'm ready? What are some of the things that you would offer? And I'll start with you, James, and I'll go to Andrew. What are some of the things you'd offer as suggestions for planting the right seeds or getting the ground ready to, how do you know that this is coming? And if I'm not going to use like safe out the box, or I'm not going to bring in a whole slew of less consultants, where do I start?
Where to start? So with our particular transformation, I mean, we did end up hiring a consultant to come in and kind of help us work through the early days of, you know, getting us some base practices, help facilitate the training because we were still trying to build the Agile team. We have, you know, the company we work at, you know, there is an Agile, you know, our Agile transformation team. So it's the coaches and we have, you know, a reporting structure where the Scrum Masters pretty much all report in through that group as well. So we've kind of put all of this, essentially this team together to kind of roll the transformation out from that standpoint. So there is some people, you know, Jason Little would have talked, you know, when he did lean change management, this would be like that transformation office that he kind of, you know, talked about in lean change management. So a lot of the things we work with stakeholders, bring all that kind of feedback in, but we really kind of wanted to get our arms around solving the problems within the organization. Some of it being predictability, some of it was quality related, and being able to kind of better respond to change. So those were like really three of the key drivers. Was really about how we operate as a development group with a roadmap to, let's make the development group the best it possibly can be, and then let's go figure out how we bring in the business once we're delivering and they become part of the bottleneck or challenge, then we'll start to be able to break into having that discussion. We put together a basic framework and we've evolved it from, you know, whatever the consultant brought in, which was Scrum plus some other practices. And we've evolved it over time, bringing in practices to augment challenges that we had. Planning was a problem. We had pretty decent rhythms once we got work to the teams. So we could have a pretty good rhythm with the you know, every 2 weeks delivering working software. But the problem up front then became planning. So now we've got a bottleneck in planning. So then we modified the PI planning process. And now we have a continuous planning model that now feeds teams. So now we have a solid rhythm and in some of the products we have, you know, we have CI/CD, we have some DevOps, we have all that stuff. So we have a continuous planning to production flow in the organization. Other groups still have challenges around bottlenecks and doing deploys and things like that. But slowly we've been working through and then evolving the methodology around that, trying to get to, you know, we've broken it into six core ways. So we have ways of planning, ways of decomposing work, ways of measuring, which is more about metrics and health of teams so we can do other lean type things, ways of understanding progress, which is more about the definitions of done, ready. We have definitions of deployable, releasable, because we need to kind of check off some boxes with some of the regulatory stuff. So, but out of those, we've started getting people focused on the outcomes and then the guardrails within those outcomes, and then letting them kind of sort out what, you know, you give them a toolbox of practices, explain to them how they work, and then let them kind of figure it out themselves.
So based upon some of the things you just said, James, it sounds to me like your organization has basically done the kitchen sink approach, where you weren't married to a particular framework per se, or even a methodology, or even a modality. It was really just grab what worked. I mean, based upon the words you just used, I heard stuff from the Phoenix Project. I heard stuff from Golden Rat's Theory of Constraints. There was some Scrum thrown in. There was a lot of DevOps stuff in there. So it sounds to me, and keep me honest, it sounds to me like you really just went where the work took you, and you tried to find novel approaches as the roadblocks appeared. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it's you know, you run the system, you find the bottleneck, you exploit the bottleneck, you make it work. Some of it started out as an experiment with one product. We got feedback for that. We took it to the next product. We experimented there with the same experiment we ran over here. It went horribly wrong. We learned why it went horribly wrong. We re-envisioned the experiment, ran it with the current product, took it back to the product that we got the original experiment from, ran it with them, found out if it worked there, if it went there, it worked there. We then brought it to another product. And then basically rinse, repeat until you find a set of outcomes and guardrails. So some of the products, you know, we start out the day with having guardrails that's about the size of a walking path. And everybody's got really kind of tight constraints. You follow the way. And then as you mature and get more consistent, you widen those guardrails with the intent to hopefully eventually get to a two-lane road. So, you know, but they have a clear set of outcomes, a clear set of things that should be kind of happening within as outcomes from those, from what we're looking for particular sets of where you're at in point of time.
Okay, Andrew, same question. Jumping off what James just said, if you come across an organization that's looking to transform, but they're not necessarily sold on the framework thing, where would you tell them to start? What do you think are some of the key things that they should identify first before they go running down this hill?
Yeah, if I had to like dream up my perfect scenario on this, it would be, you know, walking in not as a coach or a consultant, but going in as a facilitator with, you know, a call to action to the right people in the room and diving deep into what problems they're trying to solve. So what are the problem statements, right? Like we want to focus on, you know, leaning things out. We have quality issues. Our automation suffers, you know, so we have these long lead times. We want to, you know, increase our throughput, whatever it might be, but truly having that discussion from a facilitation standpoint. So going in unbiased, just there to facilitate the conversation and walk away with those outcomes, then start to look at opportunities to, you know, create a framework, use a framework, what is working within the organization, what isn't, do we need to change our framework or methodology? So really kind of using the data of the organization to reveal a plan of outcome and action around those problems of what's supporting change and what's working against it. So that to me is like the point of entry. And then the framework stuff is, in my opinion, easier because you can actually tailor the framework to work within the organization to either start to expose some of the changes that need to happen and amplify things or complement, right? And contrast.
That's an interesting way to think about it. So having someone come in, and if there's any listeners out there who've been through this experience, I'd love to hear it. Someone who started their transformation journey, not with the idea of transformation in mind, started with bringing in someone like you said, that's a novel idea, the idea of a facilitator, someone who just comes in and asks a lot of questions, right? Which I'm assuming is some of the stuff you're going through with your ORSC training, is how to asking the right questions to get people thinking in the right way to almost open up that flower, right? And have them share either overtly or inadvertently or covertly what they're trying to do so you can figure out where they want to go. I mean, that's probably the best first step you can ask for, I would think. I have a coworker friend of mine, Carolyn, who's always quoting, she quotes Alice in Wonderland, which I think is a great quote where she says, if you don't know, I think the toad says to her, if you don't know where you want to go, all roads will lead there. So if you don't know where you want to be, no matter which way you're going, it just may not be taking you where you want to go.
Oh, I thought there was a hookah smoking caterpillar reference coming in.
No, wait till we get to the spiral dynamics for organizational, for transformations. That's where the hookah comes out. So I'm going to start with you again, Andrew, then I'll go back to James. So we've talked about frameworks and we've talked about no frameworks and, you know, here's where you want to start. So what potential pitfalls, if any, would you want to let our listeners aware of? What things should you be looking out for if you're deciding to go down a path of, okay, I'm not going to stick a big box framework on it, I'm going to try and go with native. What were the things that you would think, watch out for these gotchas?
So I would say that maybe it's not a gotcha, but define the values for doing the change or wanting to do anything different, right? So what are the core values around why you want to do this change and how do you honor those? So almost an agreement amongst the organization and yourself that, hey, we want to honor these things through whatever change we decide. And this is how we want to handle it. Things when they get difficult and each other when they get difficult. So really kind of outlining the emotional what we want to honor and hold each other accountable for, and how do we want to show up when things are not going great to enable whatever change opportunity framework or approach you take. So whether it's agile, whether it's, you know, I'm sorry, agile, I have to stop doing this. Is agile's not like a framework, right? So whether it's Scrum, whether it's less, whether it's safe, whether it's, you know, you name it, whether it's, you know, my own personal framework, which is amazing and you know, is going to be big someday. No, just kidding. So whatever it is, I think that having that foundation to be built upon, and we talk about a lot, you know, especially in Scaled Agile and amongst, you know, the, you know, just lean, that foundation of has to be built, and it needs to be strong, right? You need to build upon, and you know, you can have the pillars of the house being held up by those values.
Perfect. Perfect. James, same question. Caveats, gotchas to avoid. If I'm going to go down this path, I should be aware of what?
Well, I mean, hopefully you have a organization that understands that if, as you go down this path, be ready to fall down. You better have a Costco-sized box of Band-Aids, because there's going to be a lot of skin knees. There's going to be a lot of failures. And you gotta, you gotta crack a few eggs to make some omelets, but there's a whole bunch of messed up metaphors right there. But you have to be ready to fail and to fail fast and learn and kind of chalk it up. Like, what did we actually learn? And it being okay to fail. And that's one thing that the company that we're at now has done pretty significantly well. I mean, we've been on a transformation for 3 years now, and there's only roughly 24 teams on this journey, and there's still at least another 50-60 teams that need to come on board. But we've been going through and really kind of figuring things out, learning with the organization, looking for those bottlenecks. And so, you know, as we've kind of hit some of the, you know, if I was David Marquet, I'd be telling you we need to act our way to new thinking instead of thinking our way to new actions. We've kind of hit the point in time where, you know, we've acted our way to being able to really do the practice as well. But now it's time to kind of make that shift to organizationally focus on some of the cultural aspects that are kind of holding us down from even going further. So we talk about all of these practices, we talk about all of these things that we do and put people through, but in reality, there is a paradigm shift in the culture of the company that needs to happen. And if we think that process change is messy and painful, like, you try to get deep-seated into the company's culture and the way they operate, and even looking into like hiring practices. You know, you're going to go hire a rock star developer because, dang, that guy's going to really deliver us some sweet code, but he could be completely polar dynamic with the company values and the values that you're trying to bring to your organization. And what you've done is planted a seed of, yeah, he's a great developer, but he's going to fry your culture. He's going to continue to melt down everything that you're trying to do. So, like, hey, you know, while you're working through the practice stuff, be ready to fail, but really trying to change the corporate culture to have an agile mindset, to really embody a lot of these ideas and principles that we talk about and so rarely see actually get implemented in the industry. Just be ready for a whole nother animal. But none of the safe big placemat, the Denny's placemat of safe, is not going to or the Waffle House placemat of safe.
There we go.
You're not going to get necessarily the results you're going to have without that cultural transformation. And it's going to be messy. It's going to be bloody. People are going to die.
And one thing, Jay, that James said that I just kind of want to maybe elaborate just for a second on is, I think one of the pitfalls and maybe the challenges that can be identified is we talk about fail fast, you know, for learning cycles, and it's okay to fail forward. But what I think the second part of that statement is yes, if the organization has space to fail, are they also creating that container or that opportunity to learn, right? So it can, you can just start failing, and the organization cannot allow or create any opportunity to learn because there is such a command and control or fear type driven culture.
That's a great point. And gents, we're quickly at time, so I think I'm going to want to end on that one. I want to thank the both of you for your time. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in again. If you like what you heard, please subscribe. There will hopefully be a thread on the Coalition regarding this podcast. We've been a little lax lately. Self-confession there. Once again, the usuals, you can find us on all three of us on Twitter, at Lean Left, at Scramando, at Backdoor Agile. You can find us at Agile Uprising. We have a Discord server, which actually has had some pretty good dialogue lately. There's a bunch of Agile practitioners talking about starting an online book club. So if you want to get involved in that, please feel free to drop in. As always, you can find us on all usual channels. So once again, thank you, James. Thank you, Andrew. On behalf of myself and the Agile Uprising podcast, this is the AU podcast signing out.